I thought we would have a relatively informal talk on Ecclesiastes, the third chapter, again. So we'll just commence and then make comments as we go along as to what our objective is. And of course, when you read the third chapter of Ecclesiastes, it starts out this way. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven. Now, in considering this chapter from a verse-to-verse study, much is lost from the standpoint of the theme of the chapter. Solomon is speaking from his own experience, and so when he makes certain comments, he's stating certain things that he feels are facts. Of course, the Holy Spirit is definitely operating through his observations and thus enhances its value above that from just his natural wisdom. But when he makes these statements, it isn't that we're to examine each statement he makes to glean from it every, you know, truth and every principle that's involved. Well, that can be helpful because the statements he makes are of value. But he's not stressing the detail. He's leading up to a certain matter. And when you read the very first verse, which we think is a proper beginning of this chapter, he's stating the theme. Now, this is the theme, verse 1, that to everything there's a season and a time to or for every purpose under heaven. And then he begins to enumerate them, some of them. But these are just merely examples. They're not meant for profound study. But we have to give a little pause on them. For instance, verse 2 says, there's a time to be born, a time to die. All right? And a time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill, and a time to heal. Now, any one of these, you could make a sermon and give several instances when there's a time to kill and a time to heal and a time to plant and a time to pluck up. You can give many examples. A time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. Now, when we read these various things, you could see that he's mentioning that he's, by innuendo, that there's inopportune times to mourn and improper times to dance or sing. So he's saying that all these things have their legitimate purpose under certain circumstances. So it's the circumstance that determines whether it's appropriate to weep or to sing. Now, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. Some of these things, you know, some people, they're just one-sided in their thinking. A time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep, a time to cast away. A time to rend and a time to sow. Like Jesus said, I came not to bring peace, but the sword. But that wasn't his whole ministry. He did mention sharp rebuke on occasion. But who was it to? He was usually to the scribes and Pharisees. So circumstances determined. But his main purpose was to give his life a ransom. That was the main. And another chief desire was to speak to the house of Israel. That was his mission, to feed the sheep of Israel. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. Because if one keeps silence on certain occasions, it gives asset. Silence sometimes can be understood as meaning your consent. You consent. You're giving your approval, even if you're not voicing it. And there's a time to speak. And this is appropriate. A time to love, a time to hate, a time of war, and a time of peace. Now you'll notice that in each of these verses, they're like couplets, that the word time is mentioned. That's the thing that's common to all these circumstances. A time, a time, a time. And he starts out, the very first verse, there's a time, a season, for every purpose under heaven. That's the main theme, and he's given, these are merely ensamples as to when it is appropriate that there are these occasions. And then he would understand that common sense would tell you where you could judge yourself to a certain extent when it would be appropriate to do these seasons. Now let's consider this from another standpoint. Most of these things the individual has no control over. For instance, the time to plant and the time to pluck up, that's seasonal. That's according to the seasons of nature, when crops grow and when they die, when they come to maturity and when you take away the husk. That's beyond your control. Has nothing to do with you. It's how you react to those situations. If you do not react properly in those circumstances, they're lost. You suffer. You suffer because you don't observe what these circumstances, they come to you. Now, we had nothing to do with our birth. It's the time to be born and the time to die. The day we're born, come into this world, and the day we leave this world, that's in God's hand, especially for those that are consecrated. And, of course, they're not consecrated normally when from birth except through the parent. Parent may dedicate the child. And so the theme is that we become responsible to the circumstance that develops in life, and they're not necessarily sequential. Now, when it comes to like the planting, this is annual, this is a perennial thing, spring and fall. The four seasons, they come one after the other, and they're repetitive. But many of these experiences are not repetitive, and they are not sequential related to one's life, the time span. But surely, in one's life, these circumstances arise at one time or another. So now, he just gave those examples. God, actually, by innuendo here, by inference, from the standpoint of we're reading this as a Christian, that our experiences, like some say, are tailor-made. That is, God superintends, overrules. Sometimes the adversary is involved in several of these experiences, but the Lord allows the adversary under certain circumstances to test one, and sometimes he disallows. That's up to him. But we have to respond to the circumstance. Now, when it comes to verse 9 and 10, what profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? Well, this is a question that arises down through history, especially in the feudal ages. A person gets up at sunrise and he goes to sleep at sunset. And this is day after day after day. And so some people, as the years go by, they begin to wonder, what purpose is this? There's no special joy or benefit to look for. The next day you have to work hard to just earn to feed yourself and your family. And so this is a natural question, is to what profit and what purpose is involved in connection with this. Now, in verse 10, Solomon says, I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. Well, we see that the labor that was in Genesis, in the very first book of the Bible, when the curse was pronounced upon man and woman and the serpent, that there was a purpose involved, and that we can see that man earning the bread by the sweat of his brow, and the earth bringing forth the thorns and thistles and so forth, that while this was a punishment for sin, yet on the other hand, the nature of that punishment, in strange as it may seem, has a benefit. It keeps man to that extent out of mischief. It's the wealthy people who don't have to worry about the bread tomorrow and the something that get into the excesses of the pleasures and the wantonness of sin. And thus their character is eroded and downgraded because they don't know what to do with their free time. Their unwisdom they dabble into and live under circumstances that are jeopardizing their future, is certainly their character. So to a certain extent, there is a benefit in the manner in which the curse was inflicted by God upon men. And like it says with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, that he destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah as he saw for their good. Well, you'd say it's the destruction. Well, he destroyed them before the sins that they were involved in, the type of sin, that they would become incorrigible. He destroyed them for their benefit, because had they gone on and on and on, there'd be no hope of salvage for their eternal salvation. So from that standpoint, even death can be a benefit when under that lest they become more and more hardened in sin. Now, verse 11, he hath made everything beautiful in his time. Incidentally, time, the word time. This is that theme. God hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he hath set the world in their heart so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Now, it's the first part of this verse. God makes everything beautiful in time. And that is a good thought, a very helpful thought, that if one doesn't understand something, and especially as it pertains to themselves, that it has nothing to do with their behavior, and they can't understand, they're perplexed, that there must be some reason, whether it has to do with a consecrated Christian or the general experience that is portioned as the lot of mankind, that there must be some purpose for the permission of evil. And we know as Christians now, especially at the end of the age with harvest truth, dispensational truth, we know that the permission of evil has several lessons, one of which is it's educational, it's instructive. And had we never had that experience, there might be always the tendency to want to open Pandora's box to see what's inside. Man, if they did not know what it would be to disobey God, had they no experience, it would be always a temptation which the Lord is allowing this experience on mankind so that they'll be relieved of this in the future when they get an opportunity to walk the highway of holiness, or whether it's the Christian in this age, that they see what it is to disobey God. They see the fruits, effects of sin and wanton pleasure. And so from that standpoint, if one then is granted a body in which is perfect, that they will not want to dabble with that which is of a tempting nature, because they know that it's better to have complete faith in the Creator than to want to satisfy curiosity. Now, as regards the world of mankind, he purposely hides from mankind what his intention is. And there are several reasons for that, of which we only know a few, but we might mention one is that the reason he keeps this from mankind's knowledge is that there are some people he does not want to save in the present life, and give them the opportunity of the high calling, because he knew they'd be a failure right away. They're not of the quality that he's looking for. What is that quality? Well, one is richness and faith. Not all men, I say this to your shame, Paul says, all men have not faith. But well, that's one common factor, that all those that are called and who are accepted of God, they do have faith. And it's a natural faith to start with, and that's what he wants. But he doesn't want those who, if they know and don't have this quality of faith, and then they accept the responsibilities of serving God under this circumstance, it'd be to their injury. So by keeping them ignorant is helpful to them. Even Jesus said this in his first ministry, something to the effect that they said, well, why don't you tell everybody? Well, you're telling us now, when we come to you, what you meant in this parable or sermon you gave. Why don't you let the common people know? And he says, it's unto you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. So that's one reason why he keeps the world in ignorance with regard to what is really going on. Then, verse 12, he says, I know that there's no good in them, but for man to rejoice and do good in his life. So what is being stated here is the effect that it is better that those that haven't this hunger, this desire, this faith quality, that while it's better that they are not too informed, on the other hand, he does give constructive advice. What is the constructive advice? That labor and the fruits of labor, the rewards of diligent labor, that is a benefit to them, keeping them busy, and then also they are being rewarded by living an orderly life. And so from that standpoint, if man enjoys the fruit of his labors and so forth, well, that's really nice that they should have some enjoyment in the present life, because life is filled with a lot of travail for everybody. And verse 13, also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor, it's the gift of God. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. God doeth it, that men may fear before him. And since we see that this is what is happening, God permits this, the duty of men, if they don't understand the situation, is that if they have a measure of trust, which there are people in the world, a good, and this is the type of person that will be saved ultimately, that basically they're not bad people. They do believe in God. They do want to be obedient, but they're overtaken in faults and other things. That if God withholds the information and the revealment of his will, he has a reason for it. You may not know the reason, and that when you look, for instance, at nature, and you see the awesomeness of the laws of creation, and you can see the beautiful things of nature, that the potential that exists, that you could say, well, there must be that even though under present circumstances things are not understandable, but looking at his creative works, God has some purpose. I don't know what that purpose is, but looking that he certainly in nature, you can see some of his love, some of his mercy, that he has created these things for man's pleasure, pleasure of observation, so that you just wait patiently for the Lord to reveal that. But now, as regards to those who are hungry to know, this is a different situation. So now we go to verse 15. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requireth that which is past. In the Revised Standard, it's rendered slightly different. It's really rendered the same way, but the changing of the phrases in a more mathematical arrangement. Has anyone got that?
That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away.
All right. Now, it's the first part of that. You'll notice the past tense is mentioned twice. And the past tense is appended to, in one instance, the present, and in the other instance, to the future. Now, for Solomon to understand this, he would have to reason from the standpoint of what he observes. And how he observed this, that's another matter. But let us take in today in science. At nighttime, when we look at the heavens, we're told by astronomers that this star is 1,000 light years away. That one is 5,000 light years away. Or this constellation is 1,000,000 light years away. Now they know one thing is that light travels at the rate of 186,000 miles per second. This can be demonstrated scientifically. We don't see it demonstrated scientifically, but you can read about the ingenious methods or techniques that certain scientists used to measure the time of the light in which light travels so that they can get it right down to a sort of a finite figure, like a figure that's definitive as to. But there's several peculiar things about light. Light is the only constant in nature. By that we mean everything in nature depends what you're talking about. What's your frame of reference? Are you on a train? Are you in an elevator? Are you standing on the earth? Are you in a rocket? Are you on the moon? I mean, everything is relative, depending where you are. And things change, depending, are you in this solar system or are you out in space in another solar system? All these things are variables. But what is very peculiar is that light is the only thing that no matter where you are, it goes at the same speed. No matter where you are. If you're on a train and you're approaching light, and you're traveling on that plane 185,000 miles per second, the light is coming towards you still at 186,000 miles per second, whether you're going head-on into it or you're leaving it. It stays constant. If you're leaving it, it's hitting you at that rate. If you're going towards it, it's hitting you at the same fixed rate. Now, when Einstein theorized on it, he had to come to this conclusion. Mathematically speaking, the people thought he was crazy, the scientists. But when they'd look at his formulas, they couldn't find any fault with the formula. They couldn't argue with him because he was smarter than they were. They realized, now how are we going to do? So they devised experiments. We're not going to go into these experiments. But several of them did. And they figured out, now we got to show him as wrong, that he's wrong. But they devised very ingenious experiments in different nations. They did this. Everyone proved that he was right. That whether you approach, and that was a very startling revelation. And now, spiritually speaking, this is the life, the Bible, the truth. This is the standard. This is the thing we measure everything by. This is constant. This is irrefutable. It's the same. Yesterday, today, tomorrow. I mean, it's God's thinking, God's mind. No matter what circumstance we're under, this is the source of information. And so it's beautiful that in nature, that it is the one constant, and in the spiritual realm, that it's the one constant. And that the value pi, it's a definite number, but science cannot find out the end of the fraction. And so some have carried it 100 and some decimals. And they still find they can't come to the end. And so that's a beautiful symbol, mathematical symbol of God. It's something definite, but it cannot be plumbed to its depth. But from God's standpoint, it's his concept. It's him. He is the very epitome of it. All right, now, we go back to this. Verse 15. When we look at a star, let us take one that's 100,000 light years away. That's an awesome distance. When you're looking at that star, you're not seeing it as it now is. You're seeing the light that left that star 100,000 years ago and just arrived today. It just arrived today. When you're looking at it, you're looking at something that was back there. Now, you're not seeing it as it is now. Because it's impossible. It's impossible to fathom that. Now, the awesome thing is that you take 100,000 years. You'd have to go into the future 100,000 years to see what it was when you're looking at it now. You'd have to. So,
into the future
to see. If you want to know what that constellation is now, you'd have to wait 100,000 years to see what it is now, from my standpoint, because you can't. Now let's do it. So this is what we see now, hath been. It has been. But we're not seeing it in that. Now let us do it the other way around. Let us go on to that constellation and look at the earth. Now we're there. And here's the earth now. And we're here, of course. But look from that standpoint to us now. The earth is still 100,000 light years away from your position on that earth. So now, if you want to know what the earth is now, that's looking into the future from that standpoint. That's the earth is now. This is now. But it's future from the standpoint, from that other perspective. The one, though, that's above both, he knows time perfectly. So that the past, the present, and the future are alike to God. They're alike. But from our standpoint, it's unfathomable. And so he's saying that some of these things are hidden from mankind. It's impossible to know these things except God reveals it. But his faith, Solomon, this is written near the end of his life, Ecclesiastes, that God has a purpose. And just looking at the natural creation, he sees everything is in process of a development. There's a purpose. There's a purpose going on. But we cannot fathom that purpose that God has in mind. But what we can see is we're down here and we can see how beautiful it is, the animals he's created. You know, whether they're the pets, or the various purposes that they can be. The horse pulls the plow, or you can ride horseback. They're useful, the animals and so forth. And he created them with a purpose in mind. We get some inkling. Well, then, here's man, who is far superior to the beast, that there must be something. And therefore, when you're seeing men being born and dying, faith would say, you can't understand it. And when one goes in the tomb, they don't come out. They apparently stay in there. This is his, Solomon says this later several times in his writings. But somehow, there's something future, he's saying. And that God is going to sort of redeem or restore that which seems to be beyond our comprehension. But the details, nobody knows. Except the Christian gets that insight. The Christian does. And so this is brought out when Solomon is speaking, like, according to the Spirit. Now let's go back. For instance, verse 16, moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there. Wickedness is on the throne as a judge. The judge is wicked. And the place of righteousness, that is the throne of righteousness, there's a man of iniquity sitting on that throne. It's like everything is reversed from what conscience and common sense says. This is like incompatible. the throne of justice is the throne of injustice. It doesn't make sense. So he's saying, verse 7, I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. In other words, even though this is the present circumstance, that wickedness is on the throne, he's saying that as he thinks about it, he's saying in his heart that God has some purpose, and this is going to be reversed because it's just not, it's not compatible even with the God of nature, let alone the God of the Bible. For there is a time for every purpose. Now notice he went back to verse 1. This is the same phrase he uses in verse 1. There's a time for every. And so while the scales of justice are reversed, absolutely contradict the laws of nature, it doesn't make sense. Yet he's saying there's something God has in mind because he has faith in God for every work. Verse 18, I said in mine heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are beasts. Now he's beginning to sense, using just common reason, that one thing he can see, that with the permission of evil, that it does reveal that there's something wrong with man. If you see wickedness on the throne, that has to be a wicked person on that throne of righteousness, it exposes the inconsistency of man as a creation of God, who's created with all these wonderful capabilities of discerning right from wrong and so forth, and doing good and doing evil, that the manifestation of, as far as looking at humanity is concerned, everything is crazy. It's crazy. Man is a beast. Man has basically base passions. But when you look at nature, nature, sometimes you go out, it's beautiful. You go up on the top of a mountain, let's say, like Everest, and you look out, you're in heaven, and you look down, you don't see any sin. It's a beautiful panorama. You go on the moon, and you look at the earth is just beautiful. But you don't see anything. But when you're down here, you see one thing, that man is a sinner. Man, sin exists in man. He also sees there's some good in man, yes, because that was implied earlier. That they might see that they themselves are beasts. So he's reasoning from this standpoint, well, maybe God is permitting evil just to make mankind come to their senses to see that they are like a beast with passions. That they shouldn't certainly be proud and noble, when actually it shows, predominantly speaking, it's the opposite. Now he goes, for that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. As one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. All right. Now he's observing that man, even from the standpoint of looking at him, man is a beast of the highest order. You have all kinds of animals, and then you have a human being. They have certain common things. Flesh, for instance, certain types of animals, they have flesh. They breathe. They have blood. There are certain common denominators. He's talking about the one common is that they breathe. They all have to, they depend on oxygen for sustaining life. This is a common denominator with the beast and with man. Now, when man dies, what happens? He goes down, all go to one place. Verse 20, he says, all go unto one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. And which is true. The animal dies and decays and turns into the elements. Man does the same. Whether he's put in a coffin or whether he's embalmed, that dying process is continuing. You can slow it up a little bit by filling them with embalming fluids and so on, but it's the same, that they both die alike. Now, Solomon did not have the plan of God. And the Lord sees fit that the wisdom of Solomon, that it is educational to the Christian. It's not just unprofitable to study anything that Solomon has written. That isn't the way it is, because that's, it's in the Word of God. This, and so this is like saying, this is some common sense reasoning, but he does not have the foresight to look into the future. Now, before we come to verse 21, we go back to verse 15 again from another standpoint. Now from the Apostle Paul's reasoning. This verse 15 is what's in Solomon. That which hath been is now, that which is to be hath already been. So Solomon is viewing it from that standpoint. Paul views it from another standpoint. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 3. We read, through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which do appear, that is, which do now appear. Now, the one thing that is a mental block here is the word worlds in verse 3 of Hebrews is ages, not worlds in the way it is in the King James. It comes from the word aeons, that through faith we understand that the ages were framed by the word of God. You'll notice in our charts we have like the world before the flood, the world that now is, the world that is to come. We have underneath some of it the Jewish age, the gospel age, the millennial age. That is, we see that the ages that exist have been arranged or formed by God, each with its purpose. And they were not failures. God had a purpose in each of these ages, that they were adjusted to come to a climax, to come to a happy ending, to come to a beautiful ending. That is what Paul is saying. He doesn't go into any detail here, but the subsequent examples that Paul gives, whether it has to do with Enoch or Noah or Moses or Abraham, one of them is very helpful in lightning, because in verse 7, that helps to explain verse 3. By faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, to the saving of his house. Now, at the time of Noah, there was no rain. And he's being told that there's to be this world flood, as it were, from his standpoint. It's a world flood. And that he better build this ark, and God gives him the dimensions and everything. He says, get busy and do it, because 120 years from now, I'm going to destroy all flesh. And so, for your salvation and for that of your family, this boat, which he gives the measurements of how it should be built, because Noah was not a mariner in that sense, from several standpoints, one of which is not to capsize, that under the tumultuous conditions of the flood, that these proportions that God gives, that the buoyancy of the boat will be a maximum of stability in almost like riotous circumstance, tumultuous waters and all. And so he gives them the measurements, and that's only one reason. That's a natural reason. It's spiritual also, the measurement. But he says, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, if you go back to verse 3, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. Well, it's stated in reverse order in verse 3. In Noah, it's stated in the order that after it happens, that this flood, it was to his salvation. So in Noah's day, there was no such thing as a flood being seen. But when the flood occurred, it's a past event. It's both current and then past, and his faith saved him. So faith is the door of revealment. Our belief in God, our belief in his precious word, are invaluable. And doesn't Paul say in another place that it's impossible for the natural man to perceive the things of God because they're spiritually discerned? And that it says, eye hath not seen or ear heard the things that God has in store for them that love him, but he has revealed them to us. So, you know, many take the first part of that and say, well, that's true as regards the world, but he hath revealed. But, of course, Paul says we see through a glass darkly, but at least we see something. So that the things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. Now, let's take just from another standpoint. There are so many elements. It used to be when I was a boy, there were 92 elements, and I don't know how many there are now, but they're up in the 100 to 100 and some. And some of these elements are, for instance, oxygen, hydrogen, helium, nitrogen. These are gases. These are gases. But you take two invisible things, because you can't see oxygen, you can't see nitrogen, they're invisible. They're gases. But when they're combined, take hydrogen and oxygen, two parts of hydrogen combined with one part of oxygen is H2O, is water. Water you see. So taking that which is not discernible and combining them under certain circumstances produces that which is visible, that which is something you can taste, feel, what before you couldn't. And so it's saying that the things, even from a natural standpoint that we see, came from things that were invisible originally. And that which we now see has not always been in that sense, because they were in a different state at one time before. Now we go back again to Ecclesiastes. Verse 21 and 22. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward? And the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth. Well, maybe some people know that it goes downward. Who is there of mankind that can differentiate to say back there with definiteness, with mathematical logic, that when the beast dies, he perishes for good? He goes down into the dust, the earth. That's his destiny. The destiny is downward to destruction. And that the spirit of man, that it ariseth. Now he had just said before, earlier, remember in an earlier verse, that when you look at the beast and you look at man, they both have the same breath, they go into the tomb, and neither one is resurrected. They die. And to all appearances, for good. He even uses this term, forever. But the word olam in Hebrew means for a fixed period of time of unknown length, generally speaking, for an age. Olam. And so, from man's standpoint, there's no hope from that. No, let us say, can we call it a concrete? No concrete hope. Basically, man does hope that there is something later. And you can see that today, even the ungodly and so forth. When the family and so forth, they die, they hope that, well, they now think they're up in heaven or someplace else. But there's that basic hope that Pope or Dryden had said, poets, that hope springs eternal in the human breast. But it's not a definable hope, except to the Christian. The Christian can differentiate, can distinguish that there are, let us say today, two salvations. One on the earth, one spirit, and even the spirit, there's the ancient worthies, the great company, etc., and then there's the immortality, the highest form of life. But he's saying, who knoweth though, and he's speaking from the human standpoint, that who can make this differentiation and say with definiteness, well, the human goes up, his spirit, his soul goes up to heaven, and the beast goes to the ground. While it's negative here, he does then answer this question later. For instance, this doesn't mean that there is no hope in that direction, because in the last chapter of Ecclesiastes, the seventh verse. When it's talking about the silver cord being loosed, the golden bowl being broken, the pitcher being broken at the fountain, and the wheel broken at the cistern, this is a very interesting sermon because it's talking about the human anatomy, the backbone, the nerves that go down the backbone. It talks about the heart, talks about the circulatory system, and so forth. Any one of these can produce instant death. The breaking, for instance, if one severs, the backbone nerve is severed, not pinched. Death results. If the heart stops, death results. So this, the pitcher, the cistern, and all, are different parts of the anatomy, spiritually speaking, physically speaking. But he's talking about death. And no matter how this, he's saying when one comes to the end of life, whether they die of a stroke, a heart attack, or an accident, or whatever, whatever it is, now comes, what is death? This is the next question. What is death? Then he says, then shall the dust return to the earth as it was. Now he's talking about the human. That the human body, that which was the being before that you saw, he goes down into the tomb or into the grave. But, and the spirit shall return to God who gave it. The soul, not just the oxygen return. It's the soul returns to God that gave it. That shows then the nature of the soul. That's a separate entity from the body. It's a separate entity from the breath. But the breath sometimes is used from a practical standpoint to indicate the soul. The body is sometimes used to indicate the soul, because when you go count the souls, how can you count an invisible spiritual soul? You count the body. So in some cases, the word body is implied as identifying the soul, the being. Because when you say that being, you point to somebody. You point to John, or to Paul, or to Peter. You point to them as an individual. But that isn't their soul, but it's the residence of their soul, as it were. And so he answers here that the soul does return to God, and this is like, spiritually speaking, by under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, this gives the definition. But Solomon is grieving the fact that he wasted his life, that now when he's ready to depart life, he's just coming to his senses of that he really wasted his life. He did gain invaluable information, but it was not used in the right way. He experienced this wantonness and these pleasures and so forth. And even another pathetic thing, there's an indication that he recognized in his son, who was Rehoboam. He doesn't use his name, but he sees that the son is like the father. And he's mourning the fact that he feels that he'll end up the same way as I am because of certain characteristics he sees. Now going back to chapter 3.
Chapter 3.
Of Ecclesiastes. Now the last verse says, wherefore I perceive there's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion, for who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? He's saying in the third chapter that we cannot put spiritual ears on, say we have the gospel, we preach the gospel, hoping that others will respond. But the response is almost always negative. We cannot. What happens to the Christian? They think, well, there's no hope for mankind because now is the time of salvation. If you don't accept now, you're lost forever. See? But that's not what Solomon's saying. He's saying that to laboriously try to bring man, the natural man, up to this spiritual height or realm is impossible. It's a wasted effort in itself. That's why Jesus says in the New Testament, he that hath an ear to hear, let him hear. But if the majority don't have the ear to hear, you cannot press that on them. It's impossible for them to know. So he's coming to the conclusion that this is not God's purpose, the conversion of the world at the time he was living back there, that wasn't, it was obvious that the world was not that interested in the, and it is rather odd that the very ones who wonder why their life is such a drone, what purpose is there in life, that they don't take that extra step to pray and to ask God for further light. They think it, and this is common because you'll read in literature and in here in statements that people do wonder why this, why that, but they don't pray to ask God for information. If they talk to God, it's to blame him. Why did you do this to me? Not from the standpoint of faith, of looking what purpose was involved, that you saw was wise that this happened. No, it's why did you do it? See, it's a different... So, it's better that man be involved in honest industry, good, wholesome employment, and if he is... It's like saying, if he does that in a orderly, constructive way, at least he gets food for his stomach, and there are some natural pleasures, and that's man's lot. God is not calling mankind. That he came to that conclusion. God is not calling man. Therefore, to lift man up, even to his level, Solomon's level, well, this is impossible, he's like saying. That's where David differed from Solomon. David was wiser than Solomon in certain respects, because while he had these capabilities, he did not spend the lifetime exploring them, all these avenues. He went another step higher to ask God to that, and thus David was far more spiritual than his son Solomon. But you can see the natural endowments of Solomon were inherent in David. But David is the good example of having the wisdom and properly, like it says, God give us the gift to so number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. David did that. And so the Christian in this age does that. And that faith is the saving factor. Now we'll entertain questions if there are any.
Okay. I appreciate in the last chapter the explanation of the soul. That would also apply then to the third chapter where it speaks of the spirit going up, all have one spirit. It really is the soul.
That
makes a lot of sense. And then I have another question. With this thought of light and what we see now being really a delay of what occurred so many hundreds of thousands of years ago, whatever, that would mean, wouldn't it, that actually with God's purpose to ultimately have the other solar systems inhabited, some of them could be in the process of having their surfaces ordered now, and we would not see it for a long time to come.
No.
Which is a beautiful thought. To us, they look like just vacant spheres out there, but there can be wonderful things
going on. And they're exploding
the
and all these different things. But that's, say, 100 million years ago or 100,000 years ago. I mean, you're not looking at the real present. And if you saw the real present, it'd look a lot different than it does today.
And then it wouldn't be an age of faith.
No, that's right. That's right, it wouldn't be an age.
And in verse 11, third chapter, the word world, would that better be translated age? The Revised has eternity, I believe.
No, it's age. That's what I said.
Oh,
Aeons. I said it in my talk.
Okay.
That is the ages. That he has a purpose for each age. They're adjusted. The Greek word made means, like in this, the usage here is adjusted, that it has its purpose. Each purpose has its purpose. Yes?
I was thinking in the beginning of Genesis when Adam and Eve were rejected from the garden, and he said, by the sweat of your brow, you know, they should till the soil. But it really was a blessing in spite of the fact that it seemed so laborious and how what a change. But it was really a godsend to keep him occupied and to have some initiative and a joy maybe in seeing what he could accomplish with his hands, you even that way.
You remember when David sinned, I guess in numbering the people of the Levites or whatever, and God said there are three punishments. There's three punishments. You have to choose one of them. And what does David say? Lord, you do the choosing, what you think. Now that is touching. I mean, that is, he has.
But they were pretty rough ones.
Oh, they were all
the difficult ones to make a choice. But it was right. He gave it to the Lord.
What Sister Esther commented on fits in with the thoughts in the volumes, and that's why the increase of knowledge was withheld until later on the stream of time. Because man did have to be busy with laborious efforts in order to keep himself out of trouble.
But his mind now was so taken over by it from that installation of evil now. It was not, just coming to the Lord as a new creature. That time was not open yet. And
with all the increase of knowledge that we have today, what has happened, every one of God's laws are being subverted. There's no capital punishment. People think they're better than God. That they are kinder than God, and they are more forgiving. They don't say it that way, but in reality, if they study their thinking and compare it with the thinking of the Word of God, and some of the things where statements are being made along a certain line, why, it's like they're more noble than God, supposedly. I think in those instances, that's as much a stink in God's nostrils as on the other side, where they blatantly say, that.
Also, perhaps sometimes Israel has no capital punishment.
No. That's right.
Especially they're very under the law.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
It should be done.
It's a secular government. But however, there are the Orthodox sects. Some of them believe in capital punishment, but they're not there. All the Orthodox are only 10% of the government, of the population. Of that 10%, there are certainly some that of the religious there that do believe. They do want, in fact, they want to go back to it very strictly. And it's interesting that the Muslims, they believe in capital punishment. They just beheaded four people who plotted this bomb explosion that killed some American soldiery, among others. During the Gulf War, yes.